Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Mad Jin.
So good morning, internet people. This is episode 180, and I'm still Makalua, who's actually adequately caffeinated for once. With me, as always, is Dan Q.
Sup.
That's what you're going with today, huh?
Yep.
You need some more maple syrup?
Yep.
Imagine?
Maple, bacon and maple.
Bacon. So it's, of course, the Mian Team.
Now with increased attack speed.
I don't think you needed that. You're already OP.
IAS. Always get IAS.
Did you say IAS?
IAS. Increased attack speed. Obviously.
Oh, you know, we're trying to make it an acronym, too?
It is an acronym, just not in Civ.
Oh, it already is?
Yeah.
Oh, that's sad.
It's been used for many years, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
So you're recycling.
I'm bringing a quality term to the civilization community.
Are you sure?
Of course.
I think we're going to need a shovel.
Anyway. Dan, quick, segue from this.
I haven't listened to a single complaint.
I'm not even sure I can perform miracles, Mackie, but I'll try.
Increased segue speed.
This is the second of three episodes where we're going to be profiling what's new and improved in this Civilization V expansion, Brave New World, that came out last month. As we do that, I'm actually going to start with some feedback we received from episode 179 from Alpha Shard, who is a recurring guest co-host on Polycast, as well as a most frequent player on Turncast. He said, I wanted to comment on the next two civs you guys were going to focus on. The Assyrians and Brazilians were my first two Brave New World civilizations that I played on single player, in that order. I really loved how synergistic, at Dan, the Royal Library is with my playstyle, feeding into my desire for science and war. The unique unit is also extremely useful for taking out early civs. It was a great civ to go space victory with, however I went domination. The unique ability of the leader, though, didn't help me since I was in a tech lead, but it does seem useful if you're going down a specific path in the tech tree and you can collect those techs later from the civs that you conquer. So yes, the first thing we're going to be talking about is the new civilization, well, new for civ anyway, of Assyria. Assyria's unique ability is stealing an enemy technology when taking a city can be used only once per city. And for anyone who has played the Civilization series, since the beginning, I get an instant memory recall of Civilization 1, where you would walk into a city and you would take gold and you would get, if there was a technology to get, that you would acquire that technology. But the can only be used once per city means don't even think about a rinse repeat. I'll take the city. I'd like to take it back. I'll take the city. And I will catch up. No, no, no. You will not be able to muster your forces and relish in that opportunity. It only happened once.
Oh, the pun, the pain.
Mm-hmm.
Stealth. 3-4-1. It was like a triple play.
It's good that they actually prevented that from being abused in Civ 5, because even now in Civ 4, you can capture cities and get them back and make them like you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you've gotten to know the players well enough to know we will do that.
I mean, it's still semi-abusable. You can run through an empire, burn it down to the ground, back out, let them settler spam, drop a bunch of new cities, and then run them over again.
I don't know, man. I think your chances of getting a tremendous amount of tech on your second run aren't as good.
Well, it depends on how far ahead they were, right?
Yeah, so. But the further ahead they are, the longer this process is going to take anyway.
Yeah, but if you can get half dozen extra techs.
Yeah, sure, sure. A defenseless large empire that has a tech advantage on you and sweeping them. Absolutely. Piece of cake.
Yeah.
Well, the next door neighbor that's going all culture. I think I'll just take your techs and all your stuff. Thanks.
That's true.
Beyond that unique ability, there is also a unique building and a unique unit, which was alluded to in Alpha Shard's message to us. The unique building, I'll start with that. It's the Royal Library. It replaces the library. Imagine that. It adds a great work of writing slot. And once that is filled with a great work, it provides extra experience to units trained in this city. So seeing as how you will have already researched writing in order to get the Royal Library, you can then push on to the drama and poetry technology so you can build the Writer's Guild. You can add up to 2 specialists, so that's +6 great person points toward a great writer, as well as +6 culture total. And it's the only building that contains writer specialist slots, which is also, generally speaking, crucial for a cultural victory. And we'll talk more about culture victories with Brazil next. And this works so well combined with the Siege Tower, which to me... if you could write love letters to a unit, you might write love letters to this one. If you're, of the dominating type. I think when Gods and Kings came out, we were often talking about the Huns' battering ram and how powerful that was.
It ain't nothing compared to the Siege Tower.
But it has a better name.
I'm not saying it puts the battering ram to shame.
But it does.
Mackie, I said I wasn't going to say that.
Well, you didn't. She did.
Yeah.
But I do like it that we're now finishing each other's sentences. Okay, moving on. The Siege Tower, it's a melee unit. It replaces the Catapult, which of course is not a melee unit. It has a 200% bonus for city, like the Catapult. It has plus extra sight, +1, unlike the Catapult, which has 1 less. The Siege Tower has a 33% against all ranged attacks. That's right, it starts with cover 1. So that makes it almost 16 strength against cover attacks. And the Composite Bowman, which is also available in the Classical Era, has a base range strength of 11. But what I think is amazing, and yes, this can stack with a great general, when you are next to an enemy city, other units within 2 tiles get a 50% bonus when attacking the city, which includes other siege towers. If you get all of those in together, all right, so it's kind of one of those things where when I was playing the Huns, I would have the battering rams in behind my melee units in order to protect them. Now I've got the siege towers in front of a couple composite bows I might like to bring along with me, or maybe even a warrior or two, or a spearman, whatever it is I happen to have, because they are a great wall for defense as well as a great wall for offense. If you go the honor social policy and then you get the warrior code, not only do you then receive this great general outside your capital, now you've got +15% combat as well, and then you've got, again, the 50% bonus when attacking the city, when they're next to an enemy city. You can now build siege towers 15% faster, because remember, a siege tower is a melee unit.
Surround and pound.
The only caution I would say, though, is don't be thinking about, oh, why don't I push on to physics and then get myself trebuchets, and then it'll be even better. Not necessarily, because when you upgrade to the trebuchet, some of these promotions are lost, in particular the sapper upgrade, which is the +50% bonus, which is a good thing, by the way, that it gets gets lost really in effect. The idea of a unique anything is to help a particular civilization do something better, or maybe even instead of what other civilizations can do for a specific period of time. And that shouldn't be the entire run of the game.
Except that it is.
Yeah. Why wouldn't you just keep one? Like, yeah, in your army. Like,
exactly.
They still do decently for a while before their effectiveness falls off.
Yeah, except all you have to do is stay back from the city.
Yeah, it's like an extra great general.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You hang it back from the city, have it next to the trebuchets, and then the trebuchets get the 50% bonus.
Yeah, put it out in ring 3 where the city can't shoot at it. It's fine.
Even your artillery would get the bonus.
Yep.
Stronger artillery.
Because they have a siege engine just sitting behind them. That thing, it's making us accurate.
Sure. Somebody climbs up to the top of the siege tower, looks over at the city and goes, a little to the left.
Yeah, I guess.
At that point, though, yes, they do need to be, as you progress through the eras, you don't want them on the front lines anymore, so to speak. When I say the front lines, I mean you don't want them in front of other units. You want them back to provide that 50% support, like we're getting at here. Try your best, of course, to keep them protected. I mean, at some point, even if you've got them back, they could be bombarded to death. Yes, there's the ability, of course, when your enemy lands, that you can pillage, and you'll get get a promotion as well, and you can do that to heal as well. But at some point, you're probably going to lose all of them, but
by then you've already taken over half the continent, so it doesn't really matter.
even when they're gone, you've already ransacked one or more other civilizations, maybe even some city-states as well.
Tasty city-states. Killing off city-states does give you the techs, and the best part about city-states is that they instantly get a tech if enough civs also have it.
You set yourself up in such an incredible position. I think the only time you might cry a little bit is if someone said, hey, let's play a game of Civ 5. You can be Assyria, but we're going to start in the Renaissance, okay? It's like, oh, no, I can't build them. I hate you so much.
Well, yeah, I mean, the obvious counter to the Siege Tower is the obvious counter to the Battering Ram at the same time. Siege Towers can't melee attack non-cities, so any melee unit, including horses and other such things that can just, you know, sit in front of it will prevent you from being able to do much.
No way. So, just make an extra layer of archers. LOL.
LOL. And they have them all run down by horse units and melee units, because your siege units don't help versus normal units.
Nope.
Nothing but archers.
Although a siege tower plus a bunch of archers is pretty solid. Like, just the base archer, it makes them about as powerful as, or a little bit more powerful than composite bows. So you don't even have to go up to composite bows to get that sort of power.
But if you did, that would be pretty obnoxious on cities.
Yeah.
Yeah, particularly if you start off with the archers, and then, like Majin says, they're almost as powerful as a composite bow, excluding possibility that they're going to be able to get promotions more quickly. And as long as you do your best to ensure that, hey, I'm going to take this promotion. I don't need it to heal a little bit. Oh, it just died because I didn't heal it a little bit. Well, then that unit can progress and upgrade, and then you can still have, as we were saying, you can still have the siege tower providing that support, so you can have some pretty powerful support for units in and around the siege tower, both directly and indirectly, because they're more likely going to survive longer and get more promotions and be even more powerful. As powerful as the siege tower is, attacking with just siege towers, seeing as how, you know, it's when attacking a city, it's not just, let's just do siege towers and ignore all other unit types.
Yeah, you still have to get there first. And if you can't get rid of the units around the city as well, then you have a problem.
If you're fighting against Assyria, you used to cower, oh, I don't want the battering rams to get beside my city. Well, now it's, not only do you not want the siege tower to get to your city, you don't want it within a couple of hexes, because it could still be providing that support to other units which are also attacking your city. Get them out in the field, as far away from you as you possibly can.
Scouts.
Or build the Great Wall.
Yeah, or the Great Wall. Great Wall works too.
Dan's favorite wonder.
Actually, if you're playing Assyria, even with the Great Wall, I'm still kind of like, ah.
Yeah.
But it's a little less so. Because I'm like, fine. That's fine. You can go ahead and you can bombard it, and I'll get a little. Well, I guess you wouldn't get a flesh rune in a siege tower, because it's, you know, an inanimate object. So
you get a splinter.
Oh, you just scratched the paint. Thanks, I'll just take this upgrade to cover two. That's what I actually love doing. I strongly recommend that. If people attack the siege tower and you get a promotion, unless you need to, like, it's going to die because you're looking at, you know, how damaged it is versus the city strength, combat strength of the city, maybe with a unit inside of it and other units that get hit it on their turn, and take more cover promotions. And then as you continue to progress through the ages, if you see, you know, you got, okay, Assyria's attacking me. I see their trebuchets. Why are they so powerful? Oh, there are those freaking siege towers in the back there. And if you have greater cover promotions on top of it, then you're going to extend the life of a siege tower, and it can continue to do pretty well what it was able to do ever since it started, you know, more or less.
Yeah, Assyria, strong. Massive military / science combination, which is always dangerous.
Brazil, its leader is Pedro II. He has an awesome beard. He is nicely dressed as well. Reminds me a little bit of Santa Claus, but not too much. It's not as much as, say, Charlemagne in Civ 4 and the Burger King. So that's good. It's good. This is a very late game geared Civ. Quick look at it suggests. And probably an extended amount of playing time would also suggest. Their unique unit, Prasinha. Sorry. I apologize. It's not Johnny. Where's Johnny? Anyway, it's the military unit, you strength 70. You get it at Plastics, and it is obsoleted by Mobile Tactics. It'll upgrade to mechanized infantry.
Oh, yeah, don't do that.
Huh?
I'm just saying, yes, even though you can't upgrade, you probably are not going to want to do that.
Well, yeah, it has an ability that causes success in combat to increase your Golden Age meter. And late game Golden Ages, like Golden Ages in general, tend to be kind of useful. So there is that, yes. Probably the only problem with this is that you have to wait a while to get it. Brazil or Wood Camp, unique improvements. You get +2 gold when you build it, well, per turn. And then another 2 culture with acoustics. So another late game option.
I want to say that because it's +2 culture and not +2 tourism, given that culture is your, well, cultural defense and tourism is your cultural offense, you don't necessarily need to be going towards a cultural victory to make use of Brazil, even though I kind of might have implied that at the start, because Golden Ages work well regardless of what victory condition you're going towards, as well as considerable culture. I mean, you want to have lots of jungle around you.
Well, Brazil has a jungle start bias, right?
It does, and if people disable start bias, what kind of jerks would possibly do that? Then you're going to want to try to find some jungle, and you're going to want to keep that jungle. I think that there is a point of diminishing returns, though, because it's like, well, I could have like 16 jungle. I've got no production. Well, you might want to do something with that. Maybe, you know, some on the hills or something, so you can have some kind of production, so you can actually get to the point where you can build the Brazil wood camp, because you do need machinery for it.
Yeah. You can't just go straight up all jungle.
Well, you can.
you're going to die. Well, I mean, just in pop growth alone, you're going to have problems.
I'll work on Chieftain. You're good. Yeah.
Well, you could make a wish on a wing and a prayer that you won't die, but I wouldn't recommend that.
Yeah, no, I'm just thinking, like, in a pure jungle, if you don't have a lot of bananas, you're going to have lots of problems with growth, and that's going to slow you down further and further. And even if you get the university up, if you don't have extra food floating around, the jungles won't help you.
Yeah, you won't have anyone to work what you need.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, while the Brazil wood camp is awesome for all that extra culture and stuff, you're going to have to give up some of the jungle just to be able to get production to build things or get food.
Yeah, kind of like chopping forests and jungles for nature preserves or whatever in Civ 4, which wasn't useful, unlike this. The final Brazil ability is, its special ability, which is the Carnival. Tourism output doubled and spawn rate of great artists all types increased during Golden Ages. Has a synergy, Dan likes synergy, with the unique unit.
I also like an affectation on that ability as well there, Phil.
No.
Like, what's a carnival? I don't know what you're talking about.
No.
Oh, carnival. Oh, well, now I know what you're talking about.
No. I will mispronounce all Portuguese words forever because I am incompetent at speaking the language.
Sounds like my Polish.
I'm sure I would botch other languages pretty equally well.
That segue might have been a bit premature there. Imagine we don't know if Phil has more to say on this or not.
Only that there's a couple threads along the lines of Brazil being weak early game. I wonder why that might be.
They're a severely cultural focused civ.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. You can use Brazil's unique culture side of things to stave off other AIs that are, or like AIs or other players that are going cultural while you do something else. Because you do get all those nice bonuses. So it doesn't mean that you have to go cultural to maximize it. And then do whatever you want. It's very useful when it comes to preventing ideology unhappiness from hurting you.
I think it would be a lot of fun to just spam tourism on all your friends.
Well, you do that anyways.
Yeah.
Without even intending to.
Store up some golden ages and just make sure you're optimized for mass output of tourism and just spam out tourism on them.
And speaking of which, Alpha Shard had said in response to the last episode, while with Assyria I played with tourism and culture, I really focused on it with Pedro's Carnivals. I knew this before when the Civ was first announced that we could probably chain the Carnivals together with the great artists, and I did this starting in the 1400s and lasting until my culture victory in the 1700s, so I made it last.
Yeah,
and you're sitting there with some good faith built up and you just keep buying the artists. Why put them in for tourism? Golden Age, Carnival.
Culture, you get your production boost, you get your gold boost. Yeah, of course. Super
you
long Golden Ages are always
to kill
good.
Stuff.
Exactly. And get more Golden Age points.
Yay! Mm-hmm.
Although infantry do come somewhat late. for that to be much of a benefit. But, I mean, realistically, if you're not already stringing together Golden Ages and you have to build up for the next natural one, by that point in the game, it is fairly long to get around to it unless you have a huge amount of happiness. So having a unit be able to shove you back into a Golden Age sooner, if you're at war, of course, is always good. So
how quickly do they build that up?
Well, I think it's still based on combat strength of the unit you kill.
Okay.
So if you kill a lot of later game stuff, that's pretty solid.
You're getting a late game unit. They might have decided, hey, you know, late game units are typically less useful than early game units, so maybe we'll throw them a bone. But
that's the thing. You just go floor stomp somebody, one of your neighbors, as an autocratic culture game.
Yeah.
And then you can get the boosted Carnival bonus while floor stomping them. It's like, I will beat you into liking my culture.
And then you spawn next to Assyria and die immediately anyway.
Yeah. Hey, that's a nice jungle you got there. Thanks.
Oh, speaking of boosters, Mackie.
Boosters. It took me a minute. But bump. Yes, because the boosters pulling can into space. I can can into space. Imagine can can into space. Well, it isn't specifically for science, but it works. They have Casimir III as a leader, who is another member of the Awesome Beards of Civ 5 Club. But with they've got the unique ability of each time they advance into a new age, you know, you go into classical from ancient and all that, you get a extra policy, which over the course of the game is a full extra tree. So you can go any which way you want to with Poland. Although we can also recommend military. Yes.
Really? Poland goes either way?
I said anyway. I did not specify how many ways there were. But military is really fun because they have the Winged Tsar, which is a replacement for the Lancer. One, it has an extra move, so it's 5 moves instead of 4. And its unique ability is when it does more damage than it receives, it either pushes the unit back 1, forces it to retreat, or if the unit can't retreat, it gets to hit it again. So let me just run over here from the back side of the field with my things. And oh, is that unit damaged and about to die? Well, it's dead now. Mm-hmm. That's about how that works out.
Although it can push it sideways if it can't go backwards. Can be very useful because you break flanking bonuses and stuff like that as well. Makes it easier to hit it again.
Oh, yeah. Did you want to have discipline and be next to your buddy and attack better? Oops, not anymore.
Yep, pretty much.
Like the Lancer, it also starts with formation 1. So right off the bat, there's a 33% more strength against other mounted units, which if you think about that, given the base strength is 28 and the Lancer is 25, so you got formation 1, that's combat strength about 37, and cavalry, which is in the industrial, and that's in the next era, has a base combat of 34. So it, too, can also transition well, not only from that era, but also into the next era and still be a reasonable force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, and it also starts with shock 1. So open terrain starts well.
Yeah, so that would give it 32 strength in open terrain. Musketmen of the same era, the gunpowder unit there is base 24, and riflemen is 34 base. So if you're able to get some promotions on your Winged Tsar, then as long as it's quote-unquote as long as it's open terrain, then you're going to have that extra going after, even not going after riflemen, going after gunpowder units. It doesn't just, I should just focus on this going after mounted units.
Or ignore it, which most people do.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the unique building they have, the Ducal Stables, makes this even easier because it, in addition to the normal production bonus for building mounting units, you also get 15 extra experience. So if you've already got things like the barracks or the armory up, and then you add that on top of it, you're going to be at shock 3 and then into march so fast.
Yeah, can you say stack?
Yeah, would you like to stack this and just run right over everything? The one drawback I think that Madden was talking about when he was playing through Poland is that because of the stable isn't the normal way, you can't drop your specialist buildings on the pastures. You actually have to build the pasture to get the extra gold in production bonus.
Although on that note, somebody did test it, and you can do it. You can drop the... it's just a purely text error on their part.
Okay. Well, even better then.
Until the fall patch, maybe.
Yeah, probably.
Take advantage of this while you can.
It would just be that the unique building actually follows the same logic as the base building that it replaces.
Yeah, it falls under the category.
Oops.
Oops, we did it again.
Otherwise known as the oops heading, but it just sounds cuter.
Yeah, I still haven't decided whether the extra social policy per era advance is overpowered or just about right.
Well, given that they're a horse civ focused, horse units are still not the greatest, although the Winged Tusser really does make going Lancers useful.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, this is the one time I actually want to build them.
But, I mean, realistically, even if horse units were generally useful, the Ducal Stable and the Winged Tusser are not sufficient to make them strong. If they had that and a completely different unique ability, you'd be looking at it going, well, they have one unit. And they make a unit I wouldn't normally make.
Useful.
But it does upgrade to an anti-tank gun, which makes it back to being not useful again.
Anti-tank guns. Who fills those?
Until they become helicopters, of course. Actually, I totally forget. I'm pretty sure it goes away on upgrade, but if you could have a shock march helicopter. Yeah. Well, I'm just thinking like being able to move units around with a helicopter.
Run away! Run away!
The helicopters are coming.
It's Airwolf.
Social policies are definitely not the the end-all and be-all of the culture game anymore, though they are very useful towards getting them, especially with the new aesthetics tree, which is all about culture and the culture victory. Of course, some people call it the tourism victory, but it's still part of culture overall. So the new concept for the culture victory is all about influencing your neighbors and making them love your jeans and soda pop and other such things.
Your rock music.
Well, everybody's got to love the rock music to begin with, so it doesn't really matter. It doesn't help you much.
No, they have to love our rock music.
Yeah.
Our own.
It's a much more active and play in the world form of culture victory than the prior one. I am definitely much more thrilled about that because really hitting end turn for 300 turns and then not doing anything with the world is really boring. So now there is a new culture victory. So it is you building your tourism to outdo another civ's culture to get yourself all the way up the levels to your influential level. So it starts with being unknown, then you get to be exotic and hit that level, and then from exotic you go up to familiar and then popular, and eventually you get to influential. And of course there's also one more: you can become dominant on a civ with your tourism over their culture. Now that's a rarity. I don't think I've seen that yet. Yeah, it's listed, but you should probably never hit dominant unless somebody got wiped out and they have no culture left or anything along that line. But generally, you won't see dominant, but you just need to hit influential, which counts as your tourism hitting 100% of their culture produced over the length of the game. Now, of course, this does lead to potential problems based on difficulty levels, as in lower difficulty levels, the AI might not necessarily produce enough culture, and therefore it becomes really easy to get a culture victory, as some people have noted. And of course, on Deity and Immortal, well, the AI is really good at pushing out a ton of crappy culture, i.e. if they expand and just build monuments, and therefore it can become really hard to get past their culture. Different difficulty levels lead to different strategies. On Deity and Immortal, you'll definitely want to be using great musicians to go tourism bomb the big nasty culture builders to get your influence level up. There's very little in the way of standard tourism versus standard culture that you can do that on Deity against somebody who built up a huge amount of culture. Of course, that's the Great Musician, which is one of the new great people related to tourism and the culture game. So one of their special ability is to give you 10 times the amount of tourism that you produced on the turn that they were born. 10 times that amount of tourism goes into the civ that you tourism bomb, and then I think it's 20% of that tourism also goes to every other civ. Just need to use your great musicians to bomb out the civ with the high culture defense, and all that extra little tourism built up as you go will hit all of the other ones. So you will be able to influence every civ as you go. Just don't focus on tourism bombing the weak ones. Otherwise, you're effectively wasting it. Now, of course, while there is tourism versus culture on that line, It also ties into the ideology pressure. That is, your tourism level versus their tourism level on you, and it will decide whether or not they're pressuring you or you're pressuring them. Ideology pressure is one way to get them to convert over to your, excuse me, ideology, or have you flip to theirs if you're taking too much damage. Because the new culture game also includes the ability to flip cities or flip other civs over to your ideology, which makes it easier to pressure them into you getting influential level with your tourism. Because if you're of different ideologies, they get a nice little minus 34% versus your tourism, which means that you have to get more tourism against them versus their culture. Now, of course, there's other little ways to boost up your culture. Just the pure number doesn't really matter. It's the percent increases that matter. So if you have their open borders, you get 25% boost. If you have a diplomat in their capital, you get a 25% boost. If you happen to own the world religion or of the world religion, then you get a 25% boost if they have your religion, of course. If you have a trade route, that's another 25%. Shared religion, 25%. And then having the world religion pass through the World Congress also gives you more tourism. So there is lots of boosters to getting it, including the different ideologies, because as much as the base mechanics for Culture Game is pretty well straightforward, each of the different ideologies have a different way to get to a culture victory. Of course, Order has probably the best of the bunch. There's the level 3 tenant, which gives you boosted tourism versus other civs that are less happy than you, in which case, basically, as long as you're super happy and your peasants are doing their work and they're super happy, then you're going to get other civs, peasants, to want to come join you and build your stuff just because they like it. But then there's that other nice boost in Order, which is why I think Order has the better culture setup, is that once you've converted other civs to Order, you can also get a boost versus Order civs. First, you start with making yourself more happy than the other civ and getting them to force convert over to Order with your pressure. And then once they get there, you get another big boost against them because you'll still be happier than them. But now that they're with you, you'll just control them with even more tourism boosting.
Yeah, you're talking about the level 3 dictatorship of the proletariat. That's the plus 34% tourism to civilizations that have less happiness. And then the plus 34% tourism to other order civilizations is the level 2 cultural revolution tenant.
Ah, yes.
With that level 1 in Order, you want to boost your happiness. Oh, there are a couple that you could take to increase your happiness. So from level 1. Socialist realism, plus 2 local happiness from monuments, and young pioneers, plus 1 local happiness from every workshop, factory, and solar, nuclear, or hydro plant.
Mm-hmm. Yes, each of the ideologies, due to the pressure, the unhappiness pressure that you're going to get from being a different ideology and all the tourism pressure that you're going to have, also gains a huge amount of happiness. Order, I think, has the second most potential happiness, though they have the bonus for it. I do believe autocracy actually has the most potential happiness, just because an autocrat, if you're fighting, needs more happiness to keep fighting, though they mostly get it from the barracks line with the plus 2 per on that side. But yeah, and then there's, of course, national healthcare, which all of the ideologies get the bonus happiness from, along with the other stuff. Now, of course, Order gets that nice little push with the force flipping people to you. Freedom, on the other hand, is more like a Radio Free Network, where your broadcast towers actually start producing more tourism. So with Order, you want to get super happy and force people to flip to you. With Freedom, you can actually sit back and just build up your broadcast towers and just push a ton of great works into your cities. So you don't necessarily need to use a lot of landmarks, but it is nice.
Yeah, you're talking about the level 3 media culture, plus 34% tourism generated by cities with a broadcast tower.
Yeah, exactly.
Could also construct the CN tower if you'd rather not construct broadcast towers individually.
Mm, there is that.
The Canadian wonder.
The only problem with building the CN tower is that it usually comes way late. The CN tower is on the culture path because with the new culture victory, there's also a new tech called the interwebs.
How come that doesn't give you like negative culture? I've always wanted. No, I'm just kidding.
Lolcats.
Lolcats for the win.
Use your productivity. There you go.
Where the internet gives you plus 100% tourism. You really want to get up to the internet if you're going to try and force a culture game, because it is a very nice boost. Now, of course, you do have to watch out. There is the Great Firewall, which did get changed for Brave New World to allow that one civ to negate the interwebs cultural influence bonus, which of course is on the military unit side of the late game check tree. So if there's, you know, an autocrat running around, they may actually go for the Great Wall and cause you trouble. Of course, Freedom also has a defense when it comes to Great Works. There's a level one tenant that gives you extra culture from Great Works.
Creative expression.
Yeah.
Yeah, no extra tourism, but extra culture.
Extra culture, especially in a Hermitage city and maybe even the Sydney Opera House. That'll make your cultural defense go up. You'll have more chances to defend against enemy tourism going that route. Not to mention that going for that also means that you're going to get to your level three tourism booster a little bit sooner, just by using the same Great Works. And of course, with Autocracy, join my culture or I will beat you over the head with it.
In other words, Magin's favorite.
Yeah. Autocratic culture victory. That guy bothering you? Hey, I'll come help you out. You'll love me more. And therefore, you'll flip to Autocracy. And then you'll love me even more. So Autocracy level 3 culture victory style tenant gives you plus 50%, which is actually more than both the order and the freedom based boosts. But you get plus 50% tourism with civs that you are at war with. Now, at war with as on the same side. So if one AI is in a war with another AI, if you pick a side, then the one that you're helping will get, you'll get the culture boost over. While you're busy running around beating up on the culture civ who built all of these nice little wonders, you can go take them with your autocratic army and at the same time convince others to join your war and get the autocratic boost on them and slowly convert them over to autocracy to make it easier to convert them. Not to mention, it ruins plans.
Cult of Personality, yes. Is that level 3 tenant name?
Yes, we have the personality to cult it up. Now, of course, Autocracy also has the weakest of the tourism boosters at the same time. Futurism, where you get plus 100 tourism every time you on all civs once you when you pop a great artist, musician, or writer after you get it. It is pretty weak, mostly because either you have to wait till that point in the game to start producing great artists, musicians, and writers, in which case you miss out on a lot of tourism, or you basically get very little for it, because 100 tourism later in the game is very, very little. And when you're really going for tourism, you need to push it up really high. So I would expect at least 800 to 1,000 tourism base before the percentages for a late game culture victory. And frankly, getting 100 at that point isn't going to really do much. To go along with a new culture victory is also a new diplomacy victory. No longer will you have to build the UN because it shows up in the atomic era. So the new diplo victory works very similar to the old one, except that it's much more robust and there's a lot more to do with it. Rather than, you know, just soak up city states at the end of the game and build the UN and then get your vote in at the last second, or, you know, do the whole, hey, I'm going to sell everything to you and then buy up all those city states and declare war on you crap.
now you're very actually diplomatic.
Yeah, exactly.
Always a fun way to win.
Now there is the World Congress that starts in the Renaissance when a civ gets to printing press first and meets all of the civs. So just because somebody gets to printing press first doesn't mean that they're going to found the World Congress. And of course, just because somebody met everybody first doesn't mean they get to found the World Congress. It's the first civ that does both that gets it. So once the World Congress kicks in, you can start choosing resolutions that will affect all forms of gameplay. Now, cultural victory conditions tend to like some of these proposals because there are world projects to get your boosted culture for 20-ish turns. There's ones that give you the world ideology, the world religion, the a boosted tourism output for a number of turns, et cetera, et cetera. There is proposals that will either boost or reduce the production of great artists, musicians, or writers. And on the opposite side, get boosts or reductions for great scientists, merchants, and engineers. Speaking of that, though, delegates are new, sort of. They're not really new in the fact that, you know, city-states and major civs used to get to vote. But the delegate system now is slightly different in the fact that as the World Congress grows through the eras, you get more and more delegates. So at the beginning, everybody gets exactly one vote. And city-states get none. So only the major civs are allowed to vote in the Renaissance era. Whoever the leader of the World Congress is also gets a couple extra votes. And so therefore, if you are the first to found the World Congress, you have a pretty good chance of shoving through whatever your first proposal is, just because of the extra little votes. Of course, there is the Forbidden Palace as well that gives you two extra votes. And you need, obviously, patronage to build it. So that actually ties in properly now. You need to go patronage, i.e. diplomacy, to build a wonder that gives you votes. Good stuff. Anybody who has the world religion as their primary religion also gets two extra votes. World ideology followers also get two extra votes. Of course, these are both proposals that need to pass first. City-states slowly but surely get extra votes through the eras, starting in the industrial. They get one for the industrial, and then there's the modern anatomic. They get an extra vote each time there. And, of course, it all tops up with the atomic era being the point where the United Nations is founded. And it's either when the majority of civs, or at least half of them, have hit the atomic era, as in the average has been pushed up there, or when a single civ has made it to the information age. So everybody else could be back in the industrial era, except for you, who happens to be super tech, and you hit the info era. Guess what? The UN just got founded.
Yep.
And now you have to deal with stupid game-ending votes every few turns. It'll be every 20 turns at that point, if on your own standard speed, because United Nations Diplo win vote is every other proposal. So it'll be a normal proposal where you can do normal stuff, and then the one after that will be a vote, and then back to normal proposal.
Pro tip, if you find that obnoxious, just disable diplomatic victory.
Or,
yeah. I wonder who finds that obnoxious, Dan.
It's appropriate to play the game as it was designed with all victory conditions intact.
Exactly. So what you can do is what I did in my Poland game, since that's already been out. I managed to delay getting into the info era until a proposal cycle started, then jumped into the info era so that the game had to take the time to get to the first proposal and then get to the Diplo vote. And I had all of that time to finish my space victory.
I counter your argument, Phil, by the way. Sid Meier actually said, quote, "The player is the star of our games. So therefore, if it's my game, I'm the player and I'm the star. If I disable diplomatic victory, then that is obviously how it was meant to be played, because I'm the star. So there."
You are factually wrong, good sir. And my evidence is that you have an opinion that differs from my own.
Welcome to the internet.
Yeah.
Imagine you had said in the world projects, like the World's Fair and the international games, and how great that can be for going for a cultural victory. And it certainly can. But of course, it doesn't have to be just for that. And I've seen some comments we've talked about on the show recently, like, oh, all these changes in Brave New World, there's nothing for warmongers. It's awful. It's awful.
Oh, there's lots of stuff.
What kind of warmonger game are you people playing that there's nothing in here for you?
And even though in the first stage of the World Congress, even though if you have a city-state ally, you're not getting votes, make city-states your friend and spread your either founded or adopted religion, and you can just add up the delegates, and then you can have enough votes that even if everybody votes against you every single time, it doesn't matter.
Okay. Yeah, you make city-state friends, you can just completely dominate it.
And if for some reason that city-state keeps flipping back and forth because someone else keeps taking it, then, you know, just go take it for yourself and get rid of it off the map.
That is one definite change for the Diplo victory. The actual victory itself requires you to get the majority votes, which is a number that is nicely posted up there. It starts with requiring enough votes based on the number of major civs in the game. along with the number of city-states that start in the game. But it will slowly get whittled down as civs and city-states disappear off the map. So even if a city-state is purely just conquered, rather than Austria or Venice wandering by and yoinking it, the votes required for the Diplo victory go down. So if somebody's being a pain, you don't actually have to fight them necessarily for a particular city-state. If they're being a pain and constantly taking it back from you, you can just go kill the city-state and be done with it. Because if its votes are gone, you're fine. Votes required goes down either way.
Like somebody here, you forget what you're doing, you accidentally conquer that city-state. Oops, you just won Diplo.
Yeah, oops.
Stakes for me.
Yes, they were.
And at the same time, when it comes to say, hey, vote who should be the leader of, you know, the World Congress or the United Nations, you know, excluding the diplomatic victory here, don't feel like you always have to vote for yourself. Because if the biggest bully on the planet is not your friend, find somebody else with like-minded interests and prop them up. Besides getting, obviously, a diplomatic modifier with them, they not always, but, you know, if, for example, I really don't want this luxury band because I've got a copy and I've got multiple copies and I'm making lots of money on it. Hey, want to be my friend? Here, let's trade this particular luxury. Hey, I'm going to prop you up now to the World Congress. So if someone tries to propose that, even if they're not the leader, because it's not just the leader of the World Congress that gets to make a resolution, you can block it. It works well, all those things combined.
Yeah, and that is part of the Diplo system as well, with the World Congress being around. For every single proposal, either World Congress vote to see who is the leader, you can gain or lose opinion of the AIs based on how you vote or what you propose. So if, if you propose something that AI civs do not like, as in, hey, I'm going to make my religion the world religion, any and every single follower or founder of another religion will start to hate you because of that proposal.
And if you start voting down their proposals, they'll also start to hate you.
Yes.
Yeah, something like a world religion or a world ideology, you wouldn't have to really look anywhere else. You look on the map or through the diplomacy scheme to realize, hey, they're probably not going to propose this. But it does tell you in the World Congress, and it's very helpful for proposals otherwise that you might not know whether they'd like it or not. The interface will tell you. Civilizations that will be grateful if we do this. Civilizations that will be angry if we do this. And if you see neither, then the attitude is just kind of meh.
Or you just don't know enough information.
That too.
Because there's multiple ways to get information about that. And of course, this also goes for stuff like arts funding and science funding or any of the other proposals that go through. Because, you know, an AI civ going for a culture victory is not going to be pleased if you try and reduce their production of great artists and musicians and writers. And they'll let you know about it. Now, of course, the opposite is true. If you vote for somebody for the World Congress head or the UN leader and they actually win, they will be happy with you. If an AI civ put forth a proposal and you vote for it and it passes, then they will be happy with you.
Or at least happier.
Happier. I mean, you get a diplomacy opinion bump by doing these things. And of course, if you put forward a proposal that they like, they will also be happy with you and they'll let you know it. But on the information side of things, there's a couple ways to get information. In the early game, if a civ is extremely for or against a particular proposal, the game will just let you know. It's sort of like the whole, let's found a world ideology. Well, everybody not of that ideology is going to hate it. So that's pretty obvious. But for the lower level proposals, that's a little harder to find. So it's only the ones on the extremes that will tell you without any information. But to go along with the new diplomacy system, you also have diplomats. And of course, this ties back to the cultural victory side of things. If you have a diplomat in an AI capital, then you also get a tourism boost. But on top of that, the diplomats can be used in AI capitals or other people's capitals to find out what they like about a particular proposal or if they don't like it. It also allows you to trade votes at the same time or sell votes or buy their votes. So you can find out what they think about some of the proposals, but you don't necessarily find out 100% about it. To find out everything about what they like or dislike or how they will actually vote, regardless of you trying to buy their votes, you need to both be of the same ideology and have a diplomat in their capital, at which point you will know everything about what they want to do. This doesn't work very well in multiplayer I should probably say that.
You can probably figure it out, though.
Yeah, because somebody's yelling at you over Skype.
Yeah.
Or you're yelling at someone over Skype.
Or someone's typing not so nice things about your mom.
We're saying them, too.
So both culture and diplomacy got updated. They share the diplomats. They also share the proposals. There are science-based or science victory-based projects, obviously, with the space station. There's a couple tech-related proposals in there on the diplomacy system side. There is some military side things in the diplomacy system. I mean, you can't get everybody to, you know, vote to go attack somebody. That would be bad. But you can embargo people. And that's just not a reactionary thing versus somebody who's being bad. You can embargo somebody who you don't like and are planning on attacking, and that will shut down all trade routes into them, which will shut down all of their gold from trade routes. It'll shut down religious spread. It'll shut down a little excess science that's going through the trade routes, and it shuts down their culture so they can't export their tourism via trade routes. You can definitely use that. And of course, the great shot in the arm here is, of course, both freedom and autocracy have their own ways to getting to a diplomacy victory. Autocracy has the whole level 3 tenant gunboat diplomacy, of course. If you can bully a city state with your units because you have a big military and you have units near them, etc., you will gain influence with them over time, as long as you choose not to actually bully them. It's a bit harder to deal with on higher difficulty levels with the AI just spamming units. So if you really want to use an autocratic diplovictory in a high difficulty level, you have to have an insane number of units or relative insane units. So you may actually want to pick on AIs that have huge number of units and go fight them to kill off their unit spam just to increase your ability to bully the city states. Now, of course, freedom has the much easier and much more powerful side of things when it comes to that. The level 3 tenant is now trade route based. If you have a trade route into a city state, you get influence, the treaty organization side of things. Of course, that's very, very easy to get massive amounts of influence from the trade routes. But of course, all you need to do is embargo city states, and that super powerful level 3 tenant all of a sudden becomes completely and utterly useless. So there is a balancing factor in there. The other thing is that freedom also has the ability to, with the arsenal of democracy, the ability to produce units faster and hand them off to city states for extra influence. And freedom also gets the benefit of covert ops, where you can, I think it's the cooing city states is much more effective with freedom. So basically, freedom gets the ability to coo all city states, mass pump them full of units so that they can't get bullied by the autocrat, and they can send trade routes in, and autocracy gets the ability to bully city states. Yeah. So freedom, good for diplomacy. Autocracy, you might as well just kill everybody. It's not balanced at all.
Just as an aside, let's say arts funding gets passed, so now you've decreased the generation of scientists, engineers, and merchants by 33%. It is possible right now, I have tested this, you might have difficulty getting the funding repealed if there are enough civilizations on the map that want to do that, but you might actually be able to get science funding to pass, so then it just completely negates and they cancel each other out. It's pretty funny.
It is funny. Now we fund both science and arts, and no one gets us anything, because 100% cancel. It's like, yay, that was a waste. So much for that.
Hey, it's just like the real world.
Actually, it's pretty true. I don't know. One thing that's not in here with these resolutions that last all game, but can be repealed. So anytime a proposal goes through, it can be repealed because there are things like embargoes versus civs or embargoing all city states where you can't put trade routes to either a specific civ that got embargoed or to city states. You can repeal those.
Well, and seeing as how you can't recuse yourself from the effects of the World Congress, it's like, you know what? I'm just not going to play that. No, I guess you're ending your game, aren't you?
Never defy resolution.
Yeah, it's not like Civ 4. although doing that in Civ 4 is just wanting to rage quit after you do that anyway. The unhappiness is brutal. Of course, it's always fun to get a resolution, have it pass, and then propose to repeal it. I mean, even if you propose to repeal it and then you vote against your own proposal to repeal it, you know, you'll get that flip-flop achievement. I admit I did that.
Actually, another good reason to do that is just to waste a proposal space.
Yeah, exactly.
If you don't have anything interesting to propose, just throw something in like that that you know everybody's going to vote against anyways.
Yeah, you can't pass. If it's time for you to vote, it's like, no, I decide I'm not going to put up a proposal. The game's like, uh-uh. No.
Gotta put up a proposal.
No. That's right. You gotta propose something. When we first talked about this on the show at the end of 2011, so from the 2011 Christmas special to episode 160 to now, it has to do with Civilization going online, and that's actually to be its name, Civilization Online. No, it's not Civilization World returning to Facebook. Maybe it's Civilization meets Civilization World meets Minecraft. I know that's a dangerous reference. I get that. if based on the one reasonably detailed description we have, it's a possibility, right up on Massively by Joystick. And the idea, and this is a project from XL Games, which is known for the fantasy Massively multiplayer online titles Arc Age and Lineage, that this is not a fantasy MMO. Rather, this is more accurately, an MMORPG role-playing game, because as a player, you will choose the role of a character to advance through six eras. The thing that you're probably thinking, why did you say meets Minecraft, Dan? Players actually have to do the stuff, quote-unquote, and this is a quote by a producer at 2K Games, Garrett Bittner. Players have to gather the resources, then actually build the structure. You have a town hall in your civilization where you have a crafting station. Civilization Online focus for launch on the PC. As for the business model, inkling toward, says Song, the free-to-play approach. And no, there is no date yet for the game's expected availability, but if previously announced details are true, it will only be for those living in Asia.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44121-288-7659. That's 44121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Just to get back to, I don't know, whatever.
on topic.
There's a topic?
Okay. Classics. This is an interesting article in premise. 20 video games of the past 10 years that deserve classic status.
I love it too, but Skyrim is still too new to be starting calling it a classic as good as it was.
Yeah, I think Skyrim is probably the newest game on this list. But the reason this comes up on this particular podcast is that Civ 4 is on it.
Civ 4 is number 5. Metal Gear Solid 4, Guns of the Patriots for the PS3 was 4th. The Legend of Zelda, Skyward Sword for the Wii was 3rd. World of Warcraft for the PC and Mac OS 10 was 2nd. And Halo 2 for the PC and Xbox at the top spot.
My first reaction to Civ 4 being a classic at this point is it's not that old. But if you're willing to call Skyrim a classic, well, okay, fine. And same thing with Mass Effect 3 and the other things on this list. I guess a better way to interpret this list is games the writer thinks will be remembered as classics ultimately.
Yeah. You know, it's even worse because I don't even think this guy knows what he's talking about, just based on the fact that how many of these games are actual first-person shooters or first-person hackers? Pretty much all of them.
Yeah, it's like Journey and Civ are the two exceptions on this list.
I'm not going to say what I'm thinking. Let's get to the closing quickly.
Speaking about thinking about not saying stuff, this has been episode 180 of the Polycast.net. I have been here as your host, Matt Shin, and we'll just leave a laugh track on the way out.
I thought he was going to say, and I've been here too long.
Maybe get an audience clap going on, too.
Yeah. But anyways, I've been joined by Dan Q.
Embargo this.
Makalua.
Really? This new for Skyrim? I love it, too, but geez, guys.
And the mean team.
Literally tower rushing, standing atop my siege engine.
Core date August 10th, 2013. Civilization 4, 5, and online clips copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.